Oh, snaps.
The world is finally waking up to the crap that's baked into and sprayed on kibble dog food. No longer can commercial pet food manufacturers fool us with pretty pictures and false promises. This is the raw dog food truth. The view and opinions expressed on this podcast are not intended to replace medical advice. Before starting any raw diet, do research, ask lots of questions, and consult your vet.
Well, good morning, everybody. I am Dee Dee Mercer Moffitt, the CEO of Raw Dog Food and Company, where your pet's health is our business and where friends don't let friends feed kibble. Well, today I am so excited because I've got Dr. Paul Saladino on. Now, you guys probably don't know Dr. Paul Saladino, but you're going to love him after this podcast. Now, let me tell you a little bit about this man. He uses words like species appropriate. He talks about eating from nose to tail, a carnivore diet. He talks about that organs are the multivitamins. Now, doesn't that sound like somebody that is in the raw dog food industry? Exactly, right? But Dr. Paul Saladino is actually the carnivore MD for people. How are you doing today, Dr. Paul Saladino?
I'm so good. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you are welcome. And let me tell everybody how I found you. So our son is an incredible health nut, okay? He listens to your podcast. A couple of weeks ago, he sends me the podcast where you are talking about a species-appropriate diet for dogs. And you were referencing a study about atopic dermatitis, which I got to tell you, we see all the time. And so, of course, I tuned in and I was like, oh my God, you know, listening to what you say, looking at what you recommend for people. I mean, it so mirrors what we talk about with dogs every single day. Dogs that have digestive issues, immune problems, skin problems. And you're talking about a carnivore diet for people that addresses these exact issues. Just tell me how you got into this type of diet. Meat-based diet, meat-based in organs.
I had atopic dermatitis myself.
Oh.
So, yeah. And I don't own a dog now. When I was growing up, I had horrible allergies. And my dad had horrible allergies. And my dad is another MD. He's an internal medicine doc. And my parents thought the only pet that I could have that would be hypoallergenic enough was a newt. So I had salamanders growing up. And they died as well. And then when I went away to college, my parents got a Bichon, a very hypoallergenic dog, and they loved the heck out of that dog. But I've never owned a dog, although I really love animals in general. And I'll tell you that as I've gone down this path of thinking about my own medical issues, my own autoimmune issues, specifically atopic dermatitis, which is also known as eczema, and often occurs in humans with asthma along a spectrum of atopy, I've seen the same thing mirrored in people's dogs. And I couldn't agree with you more. I've seen people that love their animals, and yet the animals just don't seem to have the health or the longevity or the freedom from chronic disease that I would expect animals of the same species to have in the wild. And I thought, this is such a perfect analogy for what's happening with humans today, because we are the same thing. As humans, I think we've forgotten this a little more. But with dogs, and I've always thought animals, especially dogs and cats, could be a great way to help their human owners understand where they've come from as animals, as life forms, and what is a species-appropriate diet for humans. Because as humans, I think we don't even think about species-appropriate diets. We don't even think about what a, quote, wild human is supposed to be like or what a wild human eats like. But most of us have a much easier time understanding that canines are wolves and they're descended from wolves. And so why are we feeding wolves beans and grains things they would never eat in the wild. And then is it any surprise, I've always wondered, that a lot of dogs get hip dysplasia or cardiomyopathy or cancers or lipomas or cataracts or lead these lives that appear to be less than optimal for dogs? And I thought, oh, this is so interesting. But your question was, where did it start for me? And for me, it was a human journey. It was a question of why do I have atopic dermatitis, despite eating what I considered at the time to be a very good diet for a human, which was a paleo diet. Now, paleo is short for Paleolithic, which is a time period that is roughly defined as a few million years ago up until a couple of thousand years ago, maybe 10,000 years ago. And so there was this idea of a paleo diet popularized by people in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s. And I thought, oh, this makes sense. I'm going to eat organs. I'm going to eat some organs. I mostly ate meat, and I ate vegetables and kale and spinach and lettuce and avocado and fruit. And I thought, oh, okay. And some nuts. This is what our ancestors ate, right? I thought. But my eczema continued. And at times in my residency at the University of Washington, it got to be very, very bad. And I had to, at that point, re-examine my concept, my paradigm of what a species-appropriate diet for humans, or at least Paul, might be. And there certainly could be some inter-individual variation, but I think that the concepts apply to most humans broadly, Homo sapiens, as a species. So I thought about this, and I heard Jordan Peterson on Joe Rogan's podcast talking about how cutting out plants resolved his autoimmune disease and helped with his sleep apnea. And I thought, that's crazy, but I want to try it. And then as I went further down the rabbit hole, and I recalled my botany from college, which was the course that I hated more than anything, and I started to dig into the life of plants, we could write a book called The Secret Life of Plants. I think that's a book, or it's a book, something like that, right? And we would understand that plants are like every other life form on the planet. They are competing at every moment to protect their space within an ecosystem. And they don't want to be eaten. Animals don't want to be eaten either, but animals can move away from us. A squirrel doesn't want to be eaten, but it can run away. A deer doesn't want to be eaten, but it's very stealthy and quick and it can move away. A wolf doesn't want to be eaten, but it has teeth and claws and it can run away. But plants are rooted in the ground. And so I thought, oh, there's a real inequality here. If you look around you, wherever you are in the world, you'll see plants. I'm sitting in Costa Rica right now. There are plants everywhere, and not a single one of them is trying to bite me or run away from me. I could walk up to any of them and just take a big bite of its leaves. I could make a salad out of palm leaves. I could make a salad out of any of these plants. But what would happen very quickly, and I would learn as an intrepid, you know, as an intrepid eater, is that they don't taste good. And I'm either going to get diarrhea or nausea or throw up, or I'm going to absolutely get killed by eating plants around me. And this is because the vast majority of plants on this planet are not edible. A very small proportion of plants will not kill you acutely, but they may not lead to optimal health. And this is because all plants have had to create defense chemicals in their roots and stems and leaves and seeds to prevent them from being overconsumed by other animals. This is just kind of botanical fact. This is ecosystems zoology. It's ecology and zoology, and it's not foreign to anyone that studies these things. But I think as consumers of food, we walk into a grocery store and we see this huge aisle of colorful vegetables, green bell peppers, red bell peppers, orange bell peppers, kale and eggplant and spinach and lettuce. And we've all been indoctrinated by our mothers who are well-meaning and by the food system, which is misinformed, to say, these plants are amazing. You should eat more plants. And if you're sick, it's because you're not eating enough plants. And in fact, it's become so twisted in our nutritional thinking that some people have even been misled to believe that you shouldn't even eat animals, that you should just eat plants because animals are bad for you. And as I went down this rabbit hole, I thought, oh my God, we have this whole thing so backwards. And you can look at the way that, quote, wild humans eat, just like you might look at the way that wild dogs eat, and get information from an anthropologic, from a historical, ethnographic context into why we've gone so far off track. So this is just the beginning. And then you can look at nutritional studies and further down the sort of more progressed rabbit hole of current clinical data. But if you look at ancestral humans or their current representations on this planet, that would be living hunter-gatherers like the Hadza tribe in Tanzania. I just got back from there and spent 2 weeks with that tribe of people. What you find is that they don't eat vegetables. They don't go around eating plant leaves unless they are frankly starving. The Hadza don't eat any nuts. They don't eat any seeds. They don't eat any grains. They definitely don't really eat plant leaves unless, like I said, they don't have a kill of animals. And all they think about all day is hunting. They hunt every day they can, and they celebrate animals, and they eat them from nose to tail over everything else. So with a translator, I got to ask the Hadza questions. What was the best day of your life? What is the best day of your life? And they would reply, the day that I hunt and kill the biggest animal and bring it back to the tribe. Okay, what do you dream about? We dream about hunting. Okay, what's your favorite food? Big animals. Specifically in Tanzania, the biggest animal they hunt is called an eland. It's a large antelope. It's about a 2,000-pound antelope. Imagine a cow and an antelope together. So this is what they think about. And I got to hunt with them on multiple occasions, and they eat the animal from nose to tail. So apparently the Hadza didn't get the memo from the CDC or the WHO telling them that red meat causes cancer, because it doesn't. And they know from all of their evolution and evolutionary history that these are the foods that humans are meant to eat first and foremost. And then the Hadza will eat seasonal fruit and things like this, and they love honey. And if you look at that, that's a very different collection of plant foods than we have been told are the plant foods that are good for us. They don't gorge on salads. Hunter-gatherers don't eat salads. Broccoli is a recent invention. Kale has the best publicist in the world over the last decade, because there's really not a lot of places in the world where kale is eaten. And where it is eaten, it's not eaten in the wild. It's eaten because it's cultivated, it's been introduced to a culture, and it's not actually a wild growing food. A quote, wild human is going to realize kale tastes horrible, it's bitter, and they're probably also going to realize that if you eat a lot of kale, you don't feel so good. And that's because kale, like most plant leaves, has defense chemicals. Specifically, kale has isothiocyanates in it, chemicals that inhibit the absorption of iodine at the level of the thyroid. So if you eat too much kale, you can give yourself hypothyroidism. And we see this throughout Africa in places where isothiocyanate containing plant foods are overeaten and their diet is poor in animal foods, leading to an iodine deficiency. And that leads to goiter, which is a huge neck. People may have seen these pictures on the internet of men and women from places in Africa that are not developed who eat a lot of cassava or other roots that have isothiocyanates that block iodine absorption at the level of the thyroid. And they have huge bulbous necks because the thyroid gland is broken because they can't get iodine from animal foods because they're not eating a lot of animal foods. So clearly the whole thing is kind of backwards. And that was what I began to realize. So I cut out plant foods from my diet and ate only animal meat and organs for a year and a half. And I felt pretty good. My eczema went away in a few weeks and only recurred when I tried to reintroduce plant foods that would trigger it. Eventually, I realized that a species-appropriate human diet can be a little bit more than just meat and organs and fat. And ideologically, I've kind of expanded the framework of a carnivore diet to include carnivore diet of meat and organs if people want to do an elimination diet. But I'm much more excited now about something called an animal-based diet, which is mostly meat and organs, and then other foods like fruit and honey that the Hadza might eat that are probably less toxic parts of plant foods. And we can talk about why they're less toxic. But that's the long-winded answer to your question. I had eczema. It plagued me. I tried to fix it with a diet that I thought was ancestrally consistent. And then I realized hunter-gatherers don't eat a lot of vegetables. And neither do wolves, to tell you the truth. Neither do dogs. And dogs definitely don't eat grains in the wild. And they definitely don't eat beans in the wild.
You know, that is something I wanted to ask you, because if I hear this statement from the veterinary community one more time, I'm going to eat green tripe raw. Here's the thing. They always say dogs need grains for their heart. Now, I don't know that you've looked into this whole dilated cardiomyopathy in dogs.
I know it well.
Okay. It was such a small study, and all of a sudden, all these dogs have DCM. I have so many people calling me and saying, my vet says my dog needs grains. And I always say, well, what is it in grains that would help your dog's heart? Because the only place that we can get sulfur amino acids, cysteine and methionine, to come together to make taurine is in what? Animal proteins. So I'm like, why don't you ask your vet, what is it in grains that we need for dogs? Can you comment on that craziness?
It's such an interesting story. And I think that it mirrors the type of scientific misinterpretation that happens in human studies and human clinical medicine as well. So my understanding of this is that the dogs that were fed a, quote, grain-free diet in a small study developed more dilated cardiomyopathy. But you know this as well as anyone. A grain-free dog food for dogs is not just meat and organs. They substituted legumes for the grains. And so what we can pretty strongly conclude from the study is that beans are toxic to dogs, that there are compounds in beans that prevent the absorption or utilization or synthesis of taurine, leading to this dilated cardiomyopathy. And this is just such a myopic perspective for the vets to say, you need a grain, you need grains in your diet to prevent dilated cardiomyopathy. No, that's complete BS. You need to not feed your dog, quote, grain-free dog food that has legumes in it. But I just can't understand how myopic vets can be with this. It just baffles me. And it really is nauseating to think that dogs are being fed grains or people are being told you must feed your dog grains. And the vets are not understanding that this is not good scientific thinking. You can't just say that a grain-free dog food causes cardiomyopathy and therefore dogs need grains. You have to understand there are multiple variables here. People make this mistake all the time in studies with humans, and it gets parroted, and physicians think that they're doing the right thing, and they're telling their patients that red meat is bad for them or that vegetables have clearly been associated with longevity, and it's all wrong because studies are misinterpreted. So the dilated cardiomyopathy thing is a great analogy for humans. But my understanding, which I think is based in a lot of solid science, is that there is no physiologic requirement for grains in canines or wolves. You'd get dilated cardiomyopathy everywhere in the wild. There would be wolves dropping dead everywhere from dilated cardiomyopathy. And everyone that feeds their dog a raw food diet would be dropping dead from dilated cardiomyopathy. It's the beans, silly. It's the beans. And just like in dogs, beans are not good for humans either. And this will fly in the face of epidemiology, which is also known as observational experiments, which are not interventional and are flawed in so many ways. But beans are seeds. If you plant a bean, it will grow a plant. That means it's a seed, but we call it a bean. But it's full of tons of lectins, which are carbohydrate binding proteins. It's full of tons of digestive enzyme inhibitors, trypsin inhibitors, all sorts of things like this. It's full of tons of other anti-nutrients because it doesn't want to get eaten, because it's the part of the plant that the plant doesn't want you to eat. So beans are not good for humans. They're definitely not good for dogs either.
I have so many customers that will call me, and of course, it's the raw diet, right? So if the dog has digestive issues or something's going on, because people have this in their mind that, oh my gosh, and there's so much bacteria, I'm going to kill my dog. And I always say to them, would you mind turning that bag over, that kibble, that premium kibble that you've been feeding, and read those ingredients on there? Now, could you tell me any of those ingredients? How much of those should your dog have? What do they mean? Are any of them dangerous? You see, they don't know any of it. But what they've been told by these, you know, people outside of the raw dog food world, is that raw dog food diets are totally contaminated with salmonella, listeria, E. coli, dangerous, dangerous, dangerous stuff. Dogs are going to die. As a matter of fact, an article just came out from the Insider magazine who said there may be small studies. I love how they say this. There may be small studies that would indicate that a raw diet increases the gut flora, increases a good gut microbiome, but the dangers outweigh, you know, when they go through this whole thing. And so I hear this day in and day out. But back to what I was saying was, people will call me. They've switched over to from a processed kibble diet to a raw diet, meat, bones, organ, fat, and something's amiss, whether they're having digestive issues, poop issues, whatever. And when I really question them, I find that they're not just putting the raw food in the dog's body. So I say, I need to know every single thing. Invariably, I hear, I'm putting green beans, I'm putting dairy, which is yogurt, dairy and sugar. I'm putting in carrots. I'm putting in all this stuff, but it must be the raw diet. So we constantly are working with our pet parents and saying, please don't put, beans, legumes, high glycemic index or load into your dog's body. They don't need these things. But for some reason, we like to mirror our dog's diet with our diet. Okay. So if we are vegans, we want our dogs to be vegans. And you would not believe this, Dr. Saladino. I don't know if you've looked into it. There is an entire group of people, an entire market for vegan dogs. Can you imagine? Vegan dogs.
It doesn't make any sense. It's not a species appropriate diet for canines. Just like a vegan diet is not a species appropriate diet for humans. I'm sorry, vegans listening to this. You can listen to my podcast, which is called Fundamental Health. A vegan diet is not species appropriate for humans or dogs. You're killing your dog.
They are killing their dog. Oh my God. Cats, can you imagine? And people will come to me and they'll have big cats, right? They'll have Savannah cats or different types of cats. And they always want to talk about, well, I'm doing, this great kibble, or I'm doing, my cat loves, these beans and green beans. I said, well, I might like crack, but it's not good for me. But here's the thing. Go to the zoo. What do these big cats? I don't care if you've got a tiny little cat. It's a cat. A cat's a cat. Okay. A dog is a wolf. And what are they eating? They're taking down other animals. And someone said to me the other day about their cat, and they said, well, I don't feed my cat beef. And I said, why not? And they said, well, because they wouldn't hunt, down a cow in the wild. And I said, well, maybe not the cat in your house, but the cats that live up here by my house, would. So they have to be big enough to be able to take that species down. But that doesn't mean that they don't eat that. So there's a lot of these misconceptions. And the other thing that I hear is that we have evolved, Dr. Paul, we have evolved to eat a vegan diet. We have evolved, dogs have evolved to eat kibble. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? Has our digestive tract changed? Have dogs' teeth changed? Has our heart changed? I mean, what would you say to people who say, well, we've evolved to not eat beef. We've evolved to eat a totally vegan diet.
That's complete baloney, for lack of a less punny statement. There's no scientific evidence to support that. There's also been no evolutionary pressure to create a vegan human, right? We previously, if we think about human evolution, 4 to 6 million years ago, primates came out of trees. Chimpanzees and bonobos were our ancestors. And the first hominid species was Australopithecus. But we have to remember that chimpanzees and bonobos are not herbivores. They're not vegans. They're omnivores. They eat meat. They eat other monkeys, though no one wants to think about it. Even if we don't want to think about all of those unpleasantries of animals eating other animals, it happens. Monkeys are not herbivores. They're not vegans. We've never been vegan. There are zero tribes of hunter-gatherers living on this planet that have ever been studied that have been found to be vegan. And when tribes of hunter-gatherers, when tribes are compared historically by people like Weston Price, those tribes that eat more meat are stronger, fitter, more robust compared to their near geographic neighbors who eat more animal foods. The classic comparison is the Kikuyu and the Maasai in Africa, with the former group eating more plant foods and the latter group eating more animal foods. And you can guess the animal food eating Maasai are the feared warriors, and the Kikuyu are much less robust. So I don't even know how someone could begin to substantiate an argument that we have evolved to eat a vegan diet. There's absolutely no evidence for that. In fact, we have evolved to eat meat because there is many lines of evidence to suggest that for Homo sapiens, or I should say for Homo habilis and Homo erectus, which were the predecessors to Homo sapiens approximately 2.6 million years ago, the inciting event which catapulted us along the road to Homo sapiens was the consumption of increased amounts of animals. Right at 2.6 million years ago, you find tons of evidence for increased consumption of animals, which is also substantiated by stable isotope data looking at bones and teeth that shows increased accumulation of stable isotopes, that is elements that are radioactive that occur in meat. They accumulate. You can tell what trophic level animals are archaeologically by looking at stable isotopes. In addition to that, we see the arisal of these double-edged tools, these bifacial tools called Acheulean tools 2.6 million years ago. We see cut marks on bones. We see mass animal graves. We see all sorts of things suggesting humans were eating more meat 2.6 million years ago. And that is when our brains began to grow. So if anything, we have evolved to eat animals. And eating meat and organs made us human. I believe there is a strong amount of evidence that meat and organs, eating animals from nose to tail, was the single biggest event catalyzing the growth of our brains, the decrease in size of our large intestine. We have a much smaller large intestine than chimpanzees and bonobos. And the transition from Australopithecine type animals to more hominid, eventually Homo sapiens type animals, with the appearance and the availability of unique nutrients found in animal foods. So humans are not evolved to be vegans. We're evolved to eat a lot of meat and organs. And where is the selective pressure for humans to be vegans? There's never been anything like that, and nor has there been any selective pressure for canines to become vegan or to eat plant foods or to eat beans or to eat grains or anything like that. This whole sort of thread of conversation is interesting because I don't know if you guys can hear it, but in the background in Costa Rica, there are howler monkeys.
Is that a monkey?
Yes.
Very nice.
There are howler monkeys from which humans are not descended that are howling in the background. So there are primates who are omnivorous in the background, but there's no evidence that humans are evolved to be vegan. That's an absurd statement. And then we can look at it from a nutritional perspective. And, you know, dog digestive tracts are actually very similar to humans. When we compare two animals, canine and humans are two of the most similar. So we can actually look at canines as a model for the way that humans might eat because we have such similar digestive tracts, similar pH in the stomach, all these types of things. But when we look at this, it's pretty clear that meat and organs are the centerpiece of both of these species' diets, humans and animals. And we have co-evolved. I mean, if anything, the last 30 to 40,000 years of coevolution of animals and humans, specifically the domestication of dogs, has meant that dogs got our animal kills. We would use dogs to track animals, use dogs to hunt animals, the had to do this, and the dogs were rewarded for a successful kill by getting part of the kill. So there's so many lines of evidence suggesting that, but
well, it's fascinating. We are talking today with Dr. Paul Saladino. He has the website carnivoremd.com. It's an amazing website. I love it. But Dr. Saladino, he is the leading authority on the science and application of the carnivore diet. And he has used this diet to reverse autoimmunity, chronic inflammation, and mental health issues in hundreds of patients, many whom had been told their conditions were untreatable. His podcast is called Fundamental Health. It is an amazing podcast. You do such a great job going over all of this. You know, we see a lot of dogs that are also, their pet parents have also been told that their conditions are untreatable. We've had many dogs, Dr. Paul, who've come through here and they have said, you know what, your dog has EPI or IBS or malabsorption issues, and the pet parents have spent $5,000 to $10,000. The dogs are on all these different drugs, and they're just getting worse and worse and worse. And I've had so many pet parents call us as a last ditch effort. And we have said, give us 2 weeks. Give us 2 weeks. What do you have to lose? You're either going to put your dog down or give us 2 weeks. And today, those dogs are healthy. They are not on any medications. They are beautiful dogs. And I just cannot understand the medical community. When you have this kind of hands-on experience in our industry, we don't have tons and tons of research papers. And again, research papers, you have to look at who's funding that research paper. What did they want to come out of that research paper? But not only that, Dr. Saladino, you would think that the veterinarian community would turn around and say, oh my gosh, that is amazing. What can we learn from that? But you know what? We get unbelievable pushback, just like you did as I was watching the YouTube video of Dr. Jaspinson, whatever her name was, that internal medicine doctor that was on The Doctors With You. She was not kind to you. She didn't want to hear what you had to say about this because she really was totally sold on the plant foods for people for health, wasn't she?
That episode of The Doctors was a debacle. They clearly lined me up to be railroaded. And The Doctors TV show has funding sources from plant-based interests, and they clearly have a plant-based bent. And so, yeah, I mean, they were not interested in hearing me. It's not really worth anyone watching it, but they did not let me talk on the show. Nevertheless, it generated a lot of negative press for them. And I was able to say some things, which hopefully piqued people's curiosity. But yeah, it was a crazy, crazy experience. And there are, there are so many parallels between humans and dogs. Vets are not telling the owners of their pets that these conditions are curable. And humans are not being told that these conditions are curable because the paradigm from which most Western medicine physicians are operating does not include that possibility, because we are trained as Western physicians to prescribe pharmaceuticals that treat symptoms. But I will tell your listeners that I have seen every autoimmune disease that I learned about in medical school reversed with dietary change. Some people do a carnivore diet. Some people do an animal-based diet, which includes fruit and honey. But all of the people have returned to incarnations of what I would consider to be a species-appropriate human diet, focused on meat and organs and animal fat, not fearing saturated fat, not fearing red meat, and sometimes adding things like fruit back to that equation or honey. And I've seen that in friends' dogs over and over. So there are now hundreds, if not thousands, of anecdotes of this. And yet the medical community can only turn a blind eye, because whether it's rheumatoid arthritis or Hashimoto's thyroiditis or Sjogren's or lupus or inflammatory bowel diseases like ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or cancers or eczema like I had or psoriasis or psoriatic arthritis or or osteoarthritis or obesity or diabetes or autonomic dysfunction. I mean, the lists are on and on. And even psychiatric illness, depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, psychotic disorders, these, I believe, are generally rooted in inconsistencies, incongruencies between our genetics and our environment. There is a species-appropriate program for diets for humans and animals. And beyond that, there is a species-appropriate way of life, which should include sunlight and moderate amounts of exercise and play. And everyone who has a dog knows this, because if you don't take your dog out in the sun, they're going to go crazy and chew your couch. But humans don't seem to get this, because we don't understand that we need the same things. But that's neither here nor there. I focus mostly on the biochemistry and the nutrition, because I think it's such a powerful tool for humans. But it is quite disheartening. And I think we will change the paradigm eventually. But in the interim, it will be a challenging task to pry the eyes of Western physicians and perhaps Western veterinarians open, and to show them against their will, or to somehow reveal to them, like, hey, look, your paradigm is limited. Your medications might help some people, but they're going to have side effects and they're not going to treat the root cause. And these conditions are almost always fixable And I think they're almost always related to non-species appropriate diets. And that is a strong statement that I will stand behind and that I have stood behind with my career and my work. And of course, there's going to be people who push back on that, but I am buttressed. I am strengthened by the thousands of anecdotes I hear, you know, every month through other ventures I have, which I can tell you about. And that remind me that we are doing the right things. Just like you've probably heard of hundreds, if not thousands, of dogs that have had these conditions reversed. You know that what you're doing is right and it makes sense. It's species appropriate and it's completely consistent with where we've come from as humans. And if you look at the medical literature through that lens, it starts to look a whole lot different. And you understand, like, oh yeah, there actually are not interventional studies with red meat showing that it's harmful. There's never been a study where people were given red meat and showing harm. It only shows good outcomes. But what we're misled by are epidemiology, observational studies that are confounded by healthy user bias and unhealthy user bias. These are the type of survey studies that will ask people, what have you eaten over the last 10 years? And then look at their health outcomes. Well, that's a correlation from which we cannot draw causative inference. And that is what countless media outlets are quoting when they try and tell you that red meat is good for you or the vegetables are invariably good for you. Red meat is bad for you, vegetables are good for you. They're looking at people's healthy behaviors rather than the actual effect of those interventions because you can't control for all little variables. I hope that makes sense to people listening, that these observational studies are extremely misleading. And what the media will report is the word correlation. It seems like every week there's a new study in the media which loves to hate on red meat that says red meat or bacon or eggs are correlated with a worse health outcome. Well, that may be true, but you cannot say that it caused it. And the narrative in the United States for the last 70 plus years, since the time of Ansel Keys and his debacle with the Seven Countries study, was to eat less meat if you were healthy. And so who eats less meat? People that get colonoscopies and mammograms and play tennis with their friends on Saturdays. So we cannot say that is the avoidance of meat that causes improved health outcomes, because there's plenty of good studies to suggest that it's in fact not that. This is something we've eaten evolutionarily forever, but it is all the other healthy behaviors that lead to good outcomes. But those two things are co-occurring and these studies cannot separate them. Conversely, who eats more red meat over the last 70 years? People who are James Dean types, people who are rebels, people who are smoking, riding motorcycles, drinking alcohol, not getting their health checkups. And this is why red meat begins to look bad in these observational studies. But when you look at interventional studies or you look at observational studies done in Asia where the narrative has been reversed, you see a completely different picture. If you look at epidemiology, observational studies in Asia, you'll find that the men who eat the most red meat have the lowest rates of heart disease. And the women who eat the most red meat have the lowest rates of cancer. How can that be? Are these meats good for Asians but bad for Americans? No. It's the fact that for the last 70 years or 20 or whenever these studies were done, in Asia, meat is associated with affluence. So who eats more meat? People that are doing the same type of things that people who eat more vegetables in the States are doing. So you get a completely different result that is invariably ignored by the medical community. And then if you look at the interventional studies, you'll find very clearly that red meat is not harmful for humans, just like it's not harmful for dogs. Now, the other piece of this equation that often gets left out, and we've kind of hinted at this a few times, but you've said it, is the nose to tail piece, the organs piece. And so it's important that people understand that when I was with the Hadza, these hunter-gatherers don't just eat meat. They eat organs. They eat liver and heart and kidney. And I know that in your raw dog food, you put in all the organs and even include bones for calcium, just like they do in a zoo. Zookeepers understand what a species-appropriate diet is for their animals. But we don't understand as dog parents, and we certainly don't understand as Western physicians, what is a species-appropriate diet is for humans. But it includes organs. It includes liver. It includes heart. It includes kidney, because those organs are always eaten by humans in the wild. And many of your listeners may say, well, maybe I feed them to my dog, but I would never eat those organs. Those organs are gross. That's our culture. And that's why I wanted to build Heart and Soil, which is the company that I referred to earlier that makes desiccated organ supplements. So we take those organs from grass-fed, grass-finished cows in New Zealand, and we put them into pills. We desiccate them, we freeze dry them so that humans can get species appropriate food that's not quite as hard to eat as raw liver. If you want to eat fresh organs, that will benefit you. But if you need that as an adjunct, I hope people who are dog parents will consider that for themselves as humans, because organs will be very helpful for them in general.
I'm going to order
those. A lot of people. Yeah, well, I know there's a lot of people who are feeding their dogs desiccated organs. And you can feed our supplements to your dogs. They're made for humans, but you could also take our supplements and open them and feed them to your dogs. Now, if you're feeding your dogs the raw food that you're giving, that you're making, your dogs don't eat our supplements. But the listener probably does, if, unless you're eating food that looks like, you know, the stuff that you give to your dogs.
I don't know humans that eat too many hearts and all of this stuff that you have, this lifeblood. I'm looking at Heart and Soil, which I said, I'm going to get this because I never, you know, as much as I am focused on pet health, I will have to tell you, I never eat organs ever. Number one, I don't like the taste of liver. My mom loves it. I can't stand it. But I will take these supplements, and you've got in here Firestarter, which I want to ask you about. And I want to ask you about lifeblood. I know what bone marrow liver is and beef organs. Awesome, awesome stuff. What the heck is Firestarter?
Firestarter is suet. So it's the stearic acid rich fat from the kidneys of cows. Stearic acid is a unique fatty acid. It's an 18 carbon saturated fatty acid that has been shown in studies in humans to turn on fat burning,
to activate our
mitochondria. So you can get this fat by eating suet, which is kidney fat, or we put it into a capsule to make it easier for people and more transportable. But Firestarter is animal fat. It is what I believe is one of the most treasured animal fats that humans ever eat. And there's actually some fascinating studies where they compare meat eaters and vegetarians, and you'll find that if you avoid meat and you avoid animal fat because you're listening to the Surgeon General or you're worried about saturated fat, you will become deficient in stearic acid. And that is not good for your cellular powerhouses, which are known as the mitochondria. When you have a low level of stearic acid, your mitochondria turn off. They have what's called fission. They separate and they turn off. They stop burning fat. And then if you supplement these people with stearic acid, the mitochondria turn back on, they fuse, they form clusters, and they start burning fat again. And so stearic acid is a nutrient that is very valuable for humans and also for dogs that we never think about. There are all sorts of these nutrients that only occur in animal meat, animal organs, and animal fat that we can't even get from plants. This sort of line of thinking completely obviates the need. Well, it basically makes it incontrovertible to argue for a vegan diet when you think about how many unique nutrients are found in animal foods. And stearic acid is one of those. So that's what's in Firestarter.
What about lifeblood? Now, one of the things that we always tell our pet parents, when you are thawing out the rolls of raw dog food, the ruptured cells and the moisture is going to leak out. Don't throw that down the drain. People say, oh my God, that's blood. I don't want to give it to my dog. And we're like, that's sort of like bone broth. That's where a lot of your vitamins and minerals are. So put that back in your dog's bowl. So would this be similar?
Lifeblood is, it is liver and spleen and actual freeze-dried blood. So we were able to collect the blood from cows and we freeze-dried the blood. And what's interesting about blood is it has all sorts of immunoglobulins, immune proteins. It has vitamin D. It has cofactors and hormones and peptides. So it is a very powerful supplement for anyone with iron deficiency anemia and also for energy for anyone that exercises. So lifeblood is one of our very popular ones. And it has freeze-dried blood, which has been prized by our ancestors, right? The Maasai will drink blood. Many of these cultures will drink blood. Animals may be drained of their blood with slaughter, but when you see an animal killed respectfully by hunter-gatherers in the wild, they drink the blood. They do not waste this stuff. It is valuable and has many unique nutrients. So we mix the blood with liver and spleen. And as we've talked about, liver has many, many unique nutrients for humans that are not found in meat. There's a large amount of folate, riboflavin, manganese, copper, all kinds of specific peptides in liver that are going to complement the nutrients in meat, but don't occur in meat in high amounts. Choline, biotin. There's a little bit of this in meat, but not a lot. And it's like, it's almost like peanut butter and jelly, and I don't really advocate for peanut butter and jelly, but liver and meat go together really well. They complement each other. They complete each other nutritionally. And then spleen is an incredible organ that no one eats unless you're with the Hadza. It's very rich in heme iron, which is the most bioavailable form of iron in the human in our bodies. It's the type of iron that we're adapted to absorb, yet another argument for meat eating in humans rather than plant iron. We're not a good absorber of plant iron, very clearly demarcated there. And spleen has unique peptides in it, splenin, splenopentin, tufsin, that have been found to be immunologically supporting. And peptides are small protein molecules. It's something that we're just beginning to learn about. They're kind of like nutrients that we never thought about. They're not vitamins and minerals, but they are signaling molecules that occur in organs uniquely and have really powerful roles in the human body. We never think about this, but there are peptides in the heart. There are peptides in the liver. There are peptides in the muscle, peptides in spleen, unique peptides throughout the body that help our bodies stay vital. And so we combined all those into lifeblood.
So, you know, when I'm listening to you talk, I'm thinking, how can people be healthy? How can you possibly be healthy if you are missing all of these things out of your diet? And it begs the question, so many vegetarians say they feel better. How can they feel better if they're not getting all of this stuff? I'm not saying they're lying, but I'm saying that I've asked people, including my best friend, why, you know, why don't you eat beef, you know? And she will say, well, she just hasn't for a long time. And, but she's been diagnosed with Hashimoto's, Rocky Mountain spotted fever. So many vegetarians say, well, I just feel better. How can they feel better when they're not getting all the nutrients they need?
So this is a great question. I wrote a book, it's called The Carnivore Code. And in the book, I had a whole section on why vegan diets work, at least temporarily. And if you ask these people, you have to do a little detective work. And I love that you're doing detective work with your customers and finding out they're actually not using just the raw dog food. But if you ask vegetarians and vegans, essentially, invariably, they will tell you that they did not just cut out meat when they went vegan or vegetarian. They also might have cut out gluten or soy or dairy or processed junk food or soda or seed oils or Tostitos and Cheetos, right? Or some vegans just eat junk food. But many of the people that have gone vegan or vegetarian will tell you that they cut out processed food from their diet with that transition. So as, you know, non-scientific humans, I don't think we're good at understanding that you can't make a conclusion about an effect unless you only change one variable. And if you change six variables and you attribute the improvement in your, the way you feel, at least temporarily, to the exclusion of meat, that's a pretty shaky position to take, because it could just be that you don't really react well to dairy. Maybe you don't react well to Coca-Cola. Maybe you don't react well to maple syrup or something else that's not good for you. And that is generally what happens. The other thing that can happen with these diets is they are inherently calorie restricted, often because it's almost impossible to get enough calories to sustain a human on a vegan diet. And if somebody's obese, that may help long term until they crater nutritionally from deficiencies. So what you will often see with vegans is they will be junk food eaters, eating, quote, cheeseburgers with processed cheese and processed buns and seed oils like corn, canola, safflower, sunflower, which are very harmful for humans, and milkshakes and french fries and whatever, and maybe like candy bars and Cheetos, and they go vegan and they eat salads and fruit and non-processed food, and they say, I feel better. Well, of course you feel better, but long term, they often have massive nutrient deficiencies. If you look at long-term vegans, you will see people who are essentially cachectic. They have no muscle mass. They are very, usually they're angry, irritable. They're not fun to be around. They don't sleep well, and they have a lot of problems unless they are supplementing with a ton of things, which kind of makes the idea of a vegan diet invalid in general. If you need to have lots of synthetic protein powders made from hemp or pea protein, which you could never get in the wild to make your vegan diet sustainable, or you need to take 10 multivitamins or a huge dose of vitamin B12, doesn't that kind of set off alarm bells to say, like, maybe your diet is insufficient in all these nutrients that occur in animal foods, first and foremost? So I'm not going to deny that people may temporarily feel better when they eliminate processed food or when they eliminate meat along with other things that could be triggering, like dairy. But I strongly believe that it is not the meat that is causing these people to feel badly. And many of them, when they reintroduce the meat, feel much better and have a huge, almost epiphany. I've had a number of well-known vegans who added meat back to their diet on my podcast, and the stories are all the same. It's after 3 or 4, sometimes 5 years, they begin to have brain fog, lose libido. I had one woman named Elise Parker who thought she was asexual, and she's in her late 20s as a woman. And adding meat back to her diet, and lo and behold, sex drive comes back, right? Energy, mental clarity returns. There was a guy on my podcast named Tim Schief, who was a world champion free runner as a vegan and actually included in the documentary Game Changers, and then began to have such health problems that he asked them to take him out of Game Changers, and they didn't use any of the footage of him. And when he reincorporated meat into his diet, he had a wet dream for the first time in 6 years, and his sex drive returned. And it's this famous story on the internet because everybody was like, oh my God, this guy ate salmon and then had a wet dream. So you can see that there are all sorts of problems nutritionally with long-term exclusion of animal products and their unique nutrients from the human diet. Short-term, perhaps they're beneficial because they're calorie restricted. Perhaps they're beneficial because someone was allergic to dairy or had problems with that. But long-term, they do not work. And we cannot conflate six variables to the fact that meat is bad for you in these people.
So how worried are you that the world is trying to go to the impossible burger and the meat that is made in a lab? They're trying to sell us on that idea. How worried are you about that in regards to how healthy is that going to be for us long term?
I think that most of your listeners will realize that that is not a species appropriate diet for humans. Would you want your dog's food to be made in the laboratory or synthesized from a synthetic meat or a plant-based dog food? No, this is a horrible idea. One of my friends likes to say, if you want to make an omelet, you've got to break some eggs. So I think that despite the apparent increase in interest in this type of thing, I think humans will quickly figure out this is a horrible idea. And when meat is outlawed, I don't think it will be, but if it were ever, you will find me in the woods hunting. I will not stop eating meat, and I will be one of the diaspora who will not comply with this, because this is what humans need to thrive. And so I think it's a horrible idea for us, and we should be very careful. Now, this is perhaps a segue into an environmental conversation that I can mention briefly, because much of the rationale for this shift is the fact that animals are supposedly bad for the environment. And when you really examine that statement, it is quite false. In 1850, there were 150 million ruminants, that is deer, antelope, bison, elk, pronghorn in North America. And yet our country was not ruined, nor was the carbon dioxide increasing in the atmosphere in terms of parts per million, nor was there global warming happening in 1850. So when animals exist on the land in an ecosystem, in a traditional way, in a species appropriate way, it's very clear that there is something happening called the carbon cycle, where if you're thinking about a cow, which is the mainly malign species, their burps have methane, which goes into the atmosphere. Methane is CH4. It's oxidized over a number of years to carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which is then inspired by plants who fix carbon dioxide into their roots and bring carbon dioxide back into the soil. Those plants are often eaten by cows, who digest the carbohydrates containing the carbon and then burp the methane. But that single carbon atom is the same carbon atom that has been circulating for millions and millions of years. There is no new carbon produced when a cow burps. It is the same carbon that was in the plant carbohydrates, that was in the carbon dioxide that the plants inspired. And in fact, regenerative agriculture, which is raising ruminants like cows on the land in a traditional way, meaning grass feeding and grass finishing with rotational grazing, just like the bison would do in the wild, has been shown via life cycle analysis to sequester carbon into the soil. In fact, it sequesters more carbon into the soil than the cows produced. It's net carbon negative. Now, all of this podcast has been about eating meat. And I think that as humans, if we care about the future of the planet and the future of generations, we should do everything we can to support this type of agriculture that is doing the grass feeding, the grass finishing, and the regeneration, the regenerative grazing of animals. And when animals are raised that way, we end up with much healthier animals and a much more evolutionarily consistent system of carbon sequestration into the soil. So we should not fear animal agriculture because of environmental concerns. We should advocate for the expansion of regenerative agriculture in our communities and support companies that are doing regenerative agriculture, providing meat for humans or for animals that are raised in that way. So it can be tough. I understand that some animal food is not going to be raised that way because there's probably multiple price points. That would be extremely expensive. But as much as we can, I think we should support that type of agriculture. And when animals are raised that way, it's good for the environment. The way that you regenerate a field that has been destroyed by monocrop agriculture is by putting animals back on it. So I have friends in Austin, Texas, with a ranch called Rome Ranch. The ranch was destroyed by monocrop agriculture in Texas before. The soil was very low in carbon, and they're raising bison on the soil. And every year they see the amount of carbon in the soil increase, and the grass gets greener. The plants grow back more and more. The way that we regenerate land that has been destroyed by monocrop plant agriculture is by putting animals back on it.
So again, misinformation, disinformation propagated by those who have a climate control agenda. Would you agree?
Absolutely. That is absolutely what is going on. It's misinformation. It's twisting of the data. And if you follow the money trail, it kind of makes sense. You look at who is investing in plant-based foods. They are companies that stand to make billions of dollars from the sentiment in the U.S. And they're the same companies that are promoting the ideology, which is wrong. There's not a lot of profit in raising animals properly. Farmers that do this do it because they're passionate about it. You don't see many farmers driving Lamborghinis, but you do see Bill Gates flying around in a helicopter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his interests are primarily financial, I believe. And there's a great saying, I think it's Upton Sinclair, that a man's understanding of something is directly tied to the way that it influences his salary. And it's very hard to convince a man of something that negatively affects his salary. That's a paraphrasing, but you get the idea.
Exactly. Dr. Judy Jasek and I, Dr. Jasek, who comes on the podcast with me every week, we always say it would be much easier for us to just promote the crappy food out there that people are sold, marketed to. You know, you got the happy dogs on the outside, and it's just a bunch of processed, crappy, cheap materials on the inside. It would be much easier for us to just tell people what they want to hear, go along with the mainstream narrative. It's very difficult. It's very time consuming, but it's a labor of love. What we are passionate about, and we see dogs, as I mentioned earlier, that are on death's door, just be revived, and they live a wonderful life. And so that's the payoff for us, even dogs that just have digestive issues or atopic dermatitis or these type of things. And when you see that cancer in dogs is at a 52%, you got to say something is not right out there. Something is amiss, right? The whole way that we address health and pet health is wrong. So this is what we do. That's what you are doing. And I'm so inspired by what you are doing. I'm going to change my diet. I love beef. I eat a lot of bison. We have a bison supplier. I eat a lot of bison. I eat a lot of beef, a lot of fish. I am going to go to your site, which is Heart and Soil Nose to Tail Supplements. You guys, these are for the pet parents. You can't give them to your dogs, but remember, heartandsoil.co. All right. Heart and Soil. I want to say soul so bad. Heartandsoil.co. Dr. Paul, when is your podcast on? Is it on every single week, Fundamental Health?
Yes, it's twice a week. So it comes out on Tuesdays and Fridays, and people can find it. There's all sorts of discussions there. I've had conversations about the environment, conversations about cholesterol, conversations about intermittent fasting, and human zoos and all kinds of things. Yeah, all kinds of stuff on there on the podcast, out every week.
That's awesome. And then your website is carnivoremd.com. Carnivoremd.com. You can find Dr. Paul. Do I say your last name right? Saladino?
That's right. It's Italian. It's like salad and dinosaur. And the joke is that I am interested in carnivore and animal-based diets, and I have salad in my last name. So how ironic is that? But I respond to that with a bit of grammatical trickery, saying that you could also write my last name as salad, ? So N-O. So, you know, salad for you? No, I will not have salad. So it could be salad I know, or people could say, oh, there's salad in your last name. But the best place to find me is heartandsoil.co. CarnivoreMD is a site that people go to, but all the materials at CarnivoreMD are at Heart and Soil. All the podcasts are there. All the videos are there. We've got blog posts there. We've got posts about regenerative agriculture and no-till nutrition. Heart and Soil is really where I put most of my focus, but people can find me through either of those portals.
Yeah. And I was just looking at, if you want to know how to combat seasonal allergies, if you want to know what toxic plants you want out of your diet, go to Heart and Soil, because I was just reading about this. It's amazing stuff. Our son does the cold plunge. He does the sauna and the cold plunge, which you're talking about. So he follows a lot of what you do. He turned us on to you, and I'm so glad he did. I want to thank you so much for being on the podcast today. I hope that we'll get you back at some point in time. When you hear from somebody who is out there helping people and has looked at some of the studies on dogs, I hope that this has given you confidence, pet parents, that you are on the right track, that you are doing the best thing you can do for your dog by feeding them a species-appropriate diet. And you want to go to Heart and Soil so that you can be the best pet parent you can be, and you can get on a species-appropriate diet. Dr. Paul Saladino, thank you so much for being on the Raw Dog Food Truth today. We hope that you have a great time there in Costa Rica with all those holla monkeys.
Been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, everybody. Remember, your pet's health is our business, and friends don't let friends feed kibble. We'll see you next week, everybody. Bye-bye.
Oh, snap.
Find out how you can start your dog on the road to health and longevity. Go to rawdogfoodandcompany.com, where friends don't let friends feed kibble, and where your pet's health is our business.
Just snap.